And welcome back to X Squared Radio. Tchaikovsky, Hymn of the Cherubim. Didn't know Tchaikovsky wrote chorus, but he did, and it's quite inspirational, and I like it. So we played it here on X Squared Radio for you. Very fitting for the subject matter we're talking about. The book is wonderful, and it's Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, the Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity, written by Nigel Turner. And we've had the wonderful privilege of having not only Nigel, but Andrew Silverman and Dr. Bickelstaff on the program with us tonight. And we're approaching this from several different points of view, because this may be, in fact, I'm convinced it is, the most profound question of humanity since the Earth cooled. We're going to go into this fact of life after life and how it plays into this equation that these supercomputer grays think they have figured out. There might be a built-in flaw in their programming, and we'll see if we can discover it. Welcome back to Hour 3 of X Squared Radio, Nigel. Here we go.
Yeah. Well, if I may say, this continuum that begins, I think, with the Shroud in terms of our current-day perspectives of things, is to try to demonstrate to humanity the size of each individual. I keep accenting this. I hope I'm not boring the audience. But, you know, you cannot say this often enough. We really do not realize the capacity we each have for eternal scale of an eternal scale of existence as such.
And why do you think that is? I mean, you have a great quote from Plato in here, and I just want to read it because it's at the beginning of the chapter, The Fact of Life After Life. It says, "A cosmic matrix of rainbow light exists around the Earth. This matrix provides souls with a number of earthly destinies from which to choose. Then, before we are born into the world, we are required to forget these memories. Maybe that's why humanity doesn't realize the great scope of their existence."
Yes. Well, Mr. Plato knew a thing or two, but at the same time, the problem with doing that is that when you forget your size and your potential grandness and beauty, you do that because if you remember it, you would do nothing. In a world of decay and diminishing returns governed by the second law of thermodynamics, it is easy to see contradictions to all of this. So it's best, I think, in overall, to have a clean slate in which you can act out whatever the propensities that are retained within what I call a morphogenic electrospatial field. It sounds an absolutely contrived description, but I was looking at some way of describing what I call a soul, a information line that is derived through the time that each individual has existed, where all information is extrapolated and preserved, and that this then comes to each of us, and as we go and gain more and more experience within worlds of diminishing returns, all we have is that inner prompt from these memories that keeps us in some kind of situation that is able to increase that and undo the restrictions that keep us trapped within physical universes. The problem is when you get a disadvantage of the size of a machine-type being doing its own thing with you and against you, you find that the scales of balance are kind of set up against this proposition of you emancipating yourself into the place that the great teacher said you could go, particularly the one that came to Judea. And I only say particularly that because it's my only experience in real terms of understanding the scale of what might be grander than humanity. And so what I'm trying to convince people in the book is take the evidence that you see before your eyes, derive it neutrally, do not bring your prejudices to bear. If you possibly can, have a look at this as neutrally as you possibly can, and then make the connections for yourself. Please don't believe what I say or what anyone else says. You are your own authority. For instance, I'll give you an example. The actual title of my book is not what I chose. It's a publisher's title, really. And it was rather embarrassing when I saw that. But, of course, the publisher had captured the inner essence of what I was trying to say. It is, in fact, a harvesting of our potential to be there forever. I'll just give you a little quote from the Bible. I mean, I'm not a great expert on the Bible, but from James. There are numerous accounts within many texts in the Coptic Gnostic Library, for instance, in which Jesus carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with alien beings should they be faced by them. Surprising, isn't it? But yeah. It's there. Most notable of these explanations is that given in the first apocalypse of James, in the Nag Hammadi Codex. And incidentally, while I say that, please, please look at all the authorities outside the four Gospels. Because I tell you what, these rascals in 324 AD, in the Council of Nicaea, whatever, took a lot of it out.
Sure, and they did.
That. They did that with aplomb because they wanted to assert their own authority over humanity. And they distorted completely the lessons of the beautiful lifetime of this lovely being, this lovely Jew that appeared 2,000 years ago. I believe, incidentally, in my own terms, this is just my opinion, I believe that his entire sojourn on this earth was to, in fact, tell us how to deal with artificial life forms that are programmed of the sort that we are facing with, as the grace. So Jesus warns in James about entities that take away souls by theft. He then tells us how to deal with such entities and to try to allude to pre-existent beings that didn't have to face this. Now, by pre-existent beings, I think that quite fits in with my theory that it is a whole system of devolution. And I think that we came in with the universe, but pre-existence was before we became formularized as physical-type beings through the simple cascade of effect that came when the universe cooled and all the rest of it and presented different forms of the manifestation of being as such. And pre-existent beings are beings, I believe, that we were like when we first came in, beings of light, full of information and understanding and so forth, that came out of an amalgam directly from the, as I said, the primal pose of the pole of harmony against its opposite, the pole of chaos. And so here we are now in our particular state, still beached, still stuck in this universe's parts, but always having ambassadors of goodwill, like the Buddha, like the prophet, the great Islamic prophet Muhammad. Yes, I mean, I know that's perhaps not supposed to be spoken about, but I tell you, if you read the Quran in English, I think a lot of people will have a great surprise of how beautiful the sentiments are there. And of course, the great Judeo-Christian and prophet Jesus Christ and so forth. These were wondrous beings, and if we could get their words exactly as we spoke them, as they spoke them, we would have to be able to acknowledge that some great distortion has been done historically.
Sure. And
that
you can have
is
your
the problem.
Pastor.
We do not believe them based upon these distortions.
You could have, your own pastor, your own religious leader tell you whatever they want to tell you. But in your heart of hearts, in your soul, you know that Jesus spoke more than 45 minutes while he was on the earth. All those red words in that book are not all everything that he said and did.
I like the way you put that, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that if you look at what he said, all the time he was saying things like whenever someone was healed, he didn't say, I've healed you or God healed you. He said, your faith made you whole.
Right.
you were always sort of showing that it was actually the individual human beings themselves who had the power. And he said, you see me do all these wondrous things. Don't you realize you can do all these things as well? Greater than these things can you do? So, and he referred to himself as the Son of Man, and he referred to God as the Father of everyone. Yet, he was sort of, in a way, he was resisting what has happened since, that he's sort of put as an idol, as something that's unattainable, that was just, there was just only one example of ever, and just to show us what we can't be. He was actually showing us what we can be.
Yeah, and the problem you see, Brooks, is that when you get a undistorted view, as much as you can of an undistorted view as it's possible these days, from looking at the texts that have been thrown out by the Vatican or by all the councils of sort of, you know, Roman Catholic religion and whatever. And incidentally, somebody threw some water over me and called me a Catholic when I was a child. And I think I recovered and became a kind of, you know, humanist, if you like. You can get a much better and more accurate purview, I think, of what might be true. I stress, might be true. One never really knows.
Well, there's a difference between being religious and being spiritual. And I think that we've...
I can't claim to be spiritual, but what I can say is I can understand why science takes a detracting view about this nonsense, as they call it, of religion and so forth, believing in an anthropocentric God and that kind of thing, a God that demands things of you and so forth. It sounds like some kind of super lord of the manor or super parent or whatever, and where you have to pay homage and worship and all the rest of it. But I think the greatest gift that has been given us by any kind of God-type principle, put in a secular way, is the freedom of will to be and understand things as we can make them, under guidance, using this wonderful paradigm of natural, neutral logic.
Well, when you break into that extra or that stuff that's been withdrawn from the truth, then you will not be surprised by the empirical experience of life. For instance, in your book, you say the interface between the physical and non-physical universe, which is really what we struggle with as third-dimensional human beings, is the light or two-dimensional deployment people claim to see in near-death experiences. You see, the near-death experience is the one surprise to religion. Religion won't let you accept the near-death experience because they don't.
And isn't that ironical, Brooks?
They don't want
isn't
you.
Isn't that ironical?
Yeah, they don't want you to realize that you transcend the physical, that heaven is really here. There's no place you're being kept out of.
Christ said it as much. The kingdom of heaven is within you. You know?
Exactly.
And in the near-death experiences, against this sort of notion that people have culturally that God is going to be judging you and so on, that's not what people experience in the near-death experience. They see some being of light there with them that's showing them what they've done, and they experience what they did to others as though it were happening to them, which fits with this idea of us all being one ultimately and the neighbor being themselves. And it's their own conscience that is judging them and giving them this urge to put right what they have done once they realize and recognize it. And perhaps that's what draws us into coming back again. Now, this idea about memory is quite interesting, about why do we not remember now about previous lives. Now, a very well-respected neuropsychiatrist, Peter Fenwick, who has done a lot of research into this these near-death experiences at the Institute of Psychiatry in London, he and his wife have been looking at the memories that people have that can be checked and verified to be shown that they'll remember an existence that they had previously in a previous incarnation and so on, things that they couldn't in that present life have known about. Now, it's interesting that a lot of the people that actually remember a previous life had a violent death during that life. Now, if you look at, for example, the sleep laboratories, they show that we're all dreaming in all of our sleeps, but we only remember those dreams that we suddenly get woken up from. So there's actually no reference within the conscious mind, which is after all a derivative of combining our sentient mind into something physical to allow for a physical existence. We've got no references to compare against to a state before life, if you like, let alone a previous life. And that's why we don't tend to remember it. And also, if you think that perhaps if this idea is correct, that Schrödinger suggested that ultimately we came from a singularity where we were all one, and the fact that we're now separate as separate individuals is a sign that we've become restricted and limited and so on in our search to experience separation. Well, that momentum of being separate will tend to make us identify our existence in terms of the ego, the particular identity of the character of the human being that we're born as at that particular point in time, and we won't have an ability necessarily to see beyond that.
Yes, and if I may just take a little time to take you through a regression experience that demonstrates this quite beautifully, it'll fascinate your listeners. There was a regression subject. Regression is, of course, a kind of hypnotic process that takes you back in time. And it's done properly. It's a very, very reliable and well-reputed type of thing. The regression subject recalled some time ago. In fact, I saw a documentary done by the BBC here in the UK showing this particular thing. A regression subject recalled that he was a Jew who lived in the town of York in England in the 14th century. Now, this chap claimed, under hypnosis, that he was burnt to death with others for his faith at the time in the synagogue during a pogrom against the Jews of York. And that's a very important historical time. Sadly, the British did this business at that time. The Jews were, in fact, subject to pogroms at that time. And the man described a whole series of events in intricate detail and identified the geography and the logistical outlay of medieval York with amazing accuracy. Now, much of it was historically known and recorded, but he claimed not to have had the slightest knowledge of medieval history of any kind and was astonished at the detail he was able to give on the subject when later listening to the audio tape record of his regression. The man was really gobsmacked, if you like, by all he was saying. He just did not have a conscious recall of anything like this. He did, however, describe much that was not known or recorded historically about the town of York. He described that there was a synagogue and its site in medieval York and the various related logistics of this particular synagogue, this place. The experts affirmed there had never been a synagogue at the place he described. And these were university experts, I understand, from the University of Oxford. His description did not fit anything that was known about York, and they, of course, dismissed it, as all these experts tend to do, as nonsense. But some years later, the authorities gave permission for an archaeological dig in the old town site that he described, and lo and behold, buried many feet below the streets, the cobbled streets of old York, as surviving today, they discovered the old synagogue in exactly the place the man had described under regression.
Wow.
Now, the audio tape record affirmed the entire series of events that had led to the man's death. He described how a group of Jews were chased and cornered in a synagogue. He described how they were chased from room to room, round corners, to a point in the synagogue where he succumbed to a fire that the people had set. He described himself, sitting against a wall when he died in one of the galleries of the synagogue. He described a medallion in great detail that he wore round his neck. Now, this is the amazing thing. To the utter astonishment of all those who investigated his claim, A skeleton was discovered in the exact place he described that he died, described by this man. And around the skeleton's neck was the medallion he described absolutely exactly. Now, many people say that reincarnation is an ancient memory that is retained because somebody's read it somewhere in some historical record. But all that can't apply to this because nobody knew that this place existed. There was no historical record of a synagogue in ancient York. So he could not have read that. And somehow this man was able to recite this past existence in intricate detail. Now, I tell you, there are many, many stories such as this. I'm just, you know, quoting this as a single example. Let me tell you, I was a little bit, averse to this idea that we've lived many times before and so on. And after doing the research I've had to do, that has culminated in the books I've written, I think I have to say that I'm totally convinced that we live again.
Well, I can tell you, having read a lot and interviewed a lot of experts on this field, that I support that idea. And I don't know about Dr. Fenwick's work, but I have read where memories are being recovered very clear about lives that are not even lived on this planet. They're lived on other planets. And the appearance of the being on that planet is not completely human.
I accept that, you know. In my third book, I speculate this, and I can't prove it. But I think that the way we travel interstellar space, so to speak, in this universe, is not in mechanically made, materially made ships because of the Einsteinian limit and the speed of light and the gathering of mass and all the rest of it. I really think that is for robots and machines that can withstand huge, huge pressures, inertial pressures and all of this. I think the way we travel is through death. I think the whole universe is open to us, where there is no speed limit, where things might happen in terms of space-time in fractions of seconds. And I think the entire universe, therefore, is open to us. And maybe we may not reincarnate back again in this particular juncture that we leave, i.e. the Earth. We might do that through this intricate process that is described by the Hindus and Eastern religions as karma and whatever. If you have some kind of debt to somebody that you are responsible for, you know, in terms of, you know, some injustice or whatever, you may have to return to repay that debt. I really don't know about that, but I can see that there is some logic to that. But I think that in a sense, if that you don't have any debts or that kind of thing, that's a wonderful venue or ability to move right across the universe. And in my second book, I don't even remember actually the title of the book, Song of the Greys,
Song
was
of
my
the Greys.
First one.
Yeah.
I'm not particularly, as you can see, I'm not particularly concerned about my books. I just put these things down and offer them to the world.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
Well, I want to know.
Not one of these commercial types of minds, let me tell you.
I want to know the real title of this book, because I want to scratch out your...
Yes. I know, it scared me when I first saw it, what they had chosen, my publishers, but because it was one of the biggest publishers in America, who am I to discuss and talk about marketing strategies and so on? But please forgive me for the title. It's not mine. It's Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. Actually, is the center of the thesis that I say, but it's a series of three books that I'm doing to try to account for the whole story. You can't just do, not even in a radio program, Brooks.
No, 3 hours is not enough time, I can tell you.
3 hours, well, it's difficult.
and it might, you know, prove to be the ultimate frustration of these beings. I don't know. In your book, you say the trouble is that these, and you put in quote, demons of the universe, do not understand why. They cannot understand the mechanism that unites with Godhead, because they are entities derived wholly and utterly from a purely physical and material paradigm. They're not spiritual beings.
They're made out of atoms. They're made out of our, of living being with life invective, you know. They're made out of that resource, basically. And I can tell you, I can pass you on to Dr. Bickerstaff, who has some ideas about this kind of thing.
Well,
yeah. I mean, this comes back to what we were speaking about earlier, about the derivation of human beings and what we are. As I said before, these things are entirely machines. Now, really, if we look at the nature of the universe being the juxtaposition between these two poles, if you like, we've got one bit mixed in with the other. And really, I think that maps in our sort of universal understanding as much as we understand in science and sort of cosmology and et cetera. At the moment, is, you know, once we look beyond the atomic boundary, which of course one must appreciate is not really a solid little ball with little electrons. These electrons, or the edges of the atoms, are really where they're in fact viewed to be, because, you know, without viewing them in theory and in physics, as I'm sure you'll agree, these things can effectively be everywhere. Nevertheless, we can have a sort of a space between these atoms at which the forces cancel out. Really, this is a sort of Lagrangian point. And, of course, we have these between planets. But, in fact, we have those between every atom. But one can immediately see that the atomic frame itself, really, atoms are really confined to being able to touch other atoms. And so they really define limit within their own sense. If we take this continuum between the atoms, effectively, we effectively have this Lagrangian, or this zero point cancellation. I mean, this is one of the principles of why they're trying to get the idea of things like zero point energy. This is part of the principle of this. But in fact, if this is where consciousness lies, which is, you know, what quantum physics is suggesting, and Hameroff and Penrose are actually suggesting this comes from, then really this continuum is the opposite of what the atoms are. So the atoms are all separate and touching each other and have limit in terms of their effect, whereas the continuum, in fact, between them, is, in fact, encompasses the whole universe. And
if I may just interpose that, because of that zero effect somewhere where all forces are balanced, you get a parody, you know, you see, Brooks, of the Godverse, where all things have no force. And within that paradigm, you get all knowing. That's where I believe thought is made, or thoughtness happens.
So in many ways, one can consider that thoughtness being straight, if you like, or as part of a continuum, and therefore everywhere, can in fact, as it becomes more and more devolved, if you like, or enforced, effectively starts to shake and generate waves, which effectively end up being really being sort of self-limiting, which is really what an atom is. I mean, I think if everything really came from nothing at the beginning of the universe, and everything's really made out of the same stuff, it's just in different operations or different conformational states during this. Now, the problem is that if we take a bunch of atoms and we get them to linearly or sequentially connect with each other in terms of these little electric potentials, then whatever we make is really just made out of the atoms. It's actually got no access, really, to the other side of the argument, which is the continuum of the other half of the universe. And within this continuum is where living being effectively comes from. This is why we're essentially isolated from the second law of thermodynamics as structures within there, because the second law, or entropy, if you like, really only applies to really the atomic to force processes, and therefore a being, if you like, a facsimile of a human being made in such a way, although it would appear to have intelligence, and bear in mind we are devolving in terms of our technologies, really the more technology we put onto ourselves, the more we look like them and appreciate really that degree of limit, we're effectively the same. So it becomes, it blurs the line as to whether, you know, how different we are from them. But in fact, this difference is intrinsic. And therefore, the greys, if you like, these little roboids, really in trying to piggyback on us to get this sort of eternal quality, if you like, outside of outside of the the laws of physics within the atomic frame is really an impossible function.
The Grazers are simply, I think, utilitarian creations to be able to withstand inertias in physical atomic enforced space. Can you imagine if a biological structure like us, right, were to ride the speeds they would have to do and to come down and decelerate and move in right angles at maybe 25,000 miles an hour, as some of our most reliable witnesses, pilots, whatever, have seen them do. If we did that, we'd be a stain on the window inside a spaceship, would we not, Brooks?
Well, there's the idea that they create, you know, their own unified field in there, and that they're not actually experiencing those forces on the inside of the vehicle.
No, indeed. But in fact, there would be a problem. And so, you know, in terms of all accounts and the research I have done from various people at very high levels in some parts of our planet, Russian, Chinese, whatever, that I've had to interview and get some perspective from, they reckon that these gray entities are in fact made from a gold, a kind of mulch of gold wires set in between a mercury-type medium and so forth. And I tell you what, as I speak, I know there are people in the United States of America who know exactly what I'm saying, and that these things are really utilitarian mechanisms to be able to move within a physical frame of existence. Now, Dr. Bickerstaff is actually describing that which is not open to them, the space between atoms, the point at which there is no force. Within that comes all that is resolved in inspiration, thought, knowing, understanding, the wonders of the ability to see and perceive. And this is the real component of being, of our being, really, in terms of our kind of hope to be, you know, existentially beings that do not end in a finite sense. So I think that it is extremely important to make a distinction between the two. And I believe further, and obviously there'll be many people who will take this as a bone of contention, and that is, I believe that our thinkability, our knowability, our understandability, sorry about to philologists about the English language, but you know, there are no words sometimes to kind of describe.
No, we make our own here on this program.
Yeah, go right ahead. Come into my mind. I think, you know, that we are an aerial for picking up this facility, that our bones, that are piezoelectric. If we move, rather like you'd move in the old days, I'm sure you had these aerials on the top of TV sets where you manipulated each arm to get the best picture. I think that in a sense, that's why we get into prayer mode, where we move in certain ways and so on. I think in some kind of way, we can receive, if you like, this mechanism from within us, within our own atoms, by manipulating a piezoelectric quotient moved by our bones and so on, and understand a little bit more. That's why when we pray, we raise our arms, or we kneel down, or we lie flat on the ground or whatever. We actually are trying to improve reception, if you like, of what is coming through the center point of the space between atoms, i.e. from this incredible other universe, the Godverse, where I think all the great teachers were trying to, you know, try and encourage us to release ourselves from, and through death go. I believe that Jesus' transfiguration, as he demonstrated before he went into Jerusalem to Peter, James, and John. I think, I don't know if you have any kind of Christian background, if you, there was this instance described in the Bible where he stretched forth his arms and he glowed brighter than the sun. And I think that he was, in some way, by using compunction, will, or whatever, and doing wonderful things that united rather than divided, he unscrewed his hydrogen, made it less atomically kind of sticky with one another, you know, in diatomic hydrogen, whatever, and he therefore was in a state of different human resolution, if you like. And then by the time they came to his crucifixion, he was almost ready to dissolve his atomic nature. And that, and in that tomb, as Dr. Silverman described, he completed the process in 3 days, and something wondrous happened. I tell you what, I think from his words, if you take his words to be true, and I certainly am not being a, you know, a convinced Catholic or Christian or whatever tribal thing they tried to stamp on me, just looking at it from a science point of view, I absolutely now am convinced that this guy demonstrated where we all want to be. And most important of all, we all can go if we believe enough that we can do this.
Well, I think that there are probably more people at that state than one would want to admit. You know, there are about 7 billion of us here on the planet right now. And honestly, what you're describing to me, this thought connection, this point in between matter, it sounds like the singularity from which we came still exists. Mm. And in some sense, at least from the one perspective that we are capable of reaching in meditation or in prayer, the Big Bang never happened.
Yes.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm very impressed with your powers of thinking.
Well, I appreciate that.
Now, talking about this connection between mind and matter, Schrödinger was always a pains to point out that he said people wonder how the two things can interrelate. But we only wonder at that because as scientists, we've made an artificial distinction. With this empirical method, we've tried to imagine that there's some physical universe that's outside of the mind and not at all related to the mind, and that's what we spend all our time studying. Now, the point is that he showed is that actually they're all one, that it's a continuum of mind and matter together. Now, there's a couple of little anecdotes that I mentioned at my talk in Italy on the Shroud about this. One is there was an inaugural lecture by the newly appointed professor of parapsychology, the first one in the UK, where he was talking about, does such a thing as psi exist? You know, this idea of extrasensory perception, mind of matter. So at question time at the end, I just raised my arm, and when the chairman pointed to me to ask my question, I didn't ask a question, I just said, I'd just like to say, in raising my arm, I've proved, at least to myself, the existence of mind over matter. We're all doing it all the time, every single moment of every day. When we're using our free will, we're all using mind over matter. Otherwise, how do we control what we do?
And or heal.
The other one, sorry?
Or heal, or anything else.
Anything at all. Whether it's, you know, writing a piece of paper on a piece of paper, whether it's going to the toilet, well, anything that we do, we're using our free will. However mundane it is, we're showing the fundamental power of mind over matter. Now, the other point was when Professor Sir Herman Bondi came to
exclude Sing a Pretty Girl from that, by the way.
when Professor Sir Herman Bondi came to give a talk about Einstein, and at the end of question time, I put it to him, Einstein's time dilation equation, that suggests that at the speed of light, there's time becomes irrelevant, that you can be everywhere instantly all at once. So how about if an observer, if a sentient being could do that? Could we also be everywhere all at once and time become irrelevant to us? And his reply was, well, that's of course forbidden because observers have mass and you'd approach infinite mass as you become. And then I said to him, hang on a second, how heavy is a mind? How much mass does a thought have? Theoretically, if there was such a thing as a light being rather than a material being, could we be everywhere all at once?
Absolutely.
And he agreed that the equations allowed for that possibility, although he didn't think that was an interesting question, he said.
The problem is, I think he thought a thought was, in fact, as heavy as a person who thought it.
and also limited to the speed of light.
So that's, for me, the clue about the image on the Turin Shroud is it's the interface between separate identity as one person and being the all, being the whole, what he referred to as our father, if you like, the original singularity that all human beings came from.
Yeah, I think this business of the Turin Shroud was quite simply an amazing resolution into the future, where this being actually saw that there would be so many people who would doubt everything that was said and so forth. He saw, I think, foresaw what men do. They distort in their own interests and so forth. They lose a wonderful sense of hope based on reality and truth, because there is this sense of wanting perhaps to survive in a hostile environment of diminishing returns.
One other thing that might have lost as well is the act of choice that this great being had to be born and go through at least one of his lives here on this earth.
But I tell you what, mate, I think that, you know, forgive me the familiar invective, but that's the way we talk to people we like over here. Can we say this? But this guy actually is doing exactly what developed and wondrous being out there in the universe, perhaps in planets less enforced than ours, will do anyway. Let's look at what would happen if we walk on the street with some friends of ours and somebody falls down. Our immediate response is to bend down and help that individual up, or try to make sure that he was all right.
Are they in New York City, or is this somewhere else?
Well, actually, you're quite right. I walked in New York some years ago, and I passed three dead bodies on the street, and people just walked past them. And I thought to myself, goodness, there's a lot to be taught in this place. But, you know what I mean, I think, sure. Brooke, that most human beings would immediately bend down and pick the individual up. So our intrinsic nature is one to unite, is to bring things together. And maybe 200,000 odd years ago, a bit of bacterium with its mitochondria was introduced for other purposes by an alien mechanism that actually then made us more expedient in their value terms rather than ours. And that, I think, may be a lesson we all have to investigate at least. I'm not claiming that is true. As I have to say now, I'm not claiming anything I say is true. I put the things down in the book to ask people to consider this with their best auspices, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yes, and I like the implications that there really is no bearded being out there in the universe saying, you go to heaven, you go to hell, you go to heaven, you go to hell. We are sentient beings that judge ourselves moment by moment, instantaneous.
Yeah. And that's a lovely thing, is that we have no lording over things in our own personal being. We are the only lord we are. And that's the glory of it all, that we have that enormous power, that we can do that for ourselves, that each individual has total free will. And just simply by changing your mind and accepting truly, deeply, that something is right or wrong, we can structure the progress of our future.
Well, maybe we don't have to marshal a high-tech army or a secret government to protect ourselves against the Greys. Maybe we just need to be aware that
that's the secret. That's the secret. Now, whatever they may do to us, whatever the cartels are, whatever these things might have been promised by the Greys that may be controlling our planet, maybe for some future scope where they want to claim the whole darn thing by taking the rest of us out. You know, there are people who suggested that to me. Some people in the Russian Air Force suggested that this may be a paradigm that is suitable to describe why people are hiding this from the rest of the world.
Right.
In fact, I had two American colonels say this to me, too. They had the same kind of idea. Now I find that some of your most distinguished individuals, including astronauts, are claiming that they have personally verified that there is an entity outside the scope of our planet that has a technology that they have witnessed, and you know, that's good enough for me, mate, I'll tell you.
Well, it's disconcerting to sit there with the medals all over your chest, the stars on your shoulders, and be able to say something is walking
through our... But
America is
more than medals on a chest and stars on your shoulder. America was conceived by some very wise and beautiful men. And if America is what America should be, that's one thing. But what America or any country has to do is to try to strive for what it should be against what men and some unworthy men might make of it.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think that the embarrassment comes from, the energy of secrecy comes from not being able to assure the people over which they have purview.
You bet.
They cannot guarantee the sovereignty of the airspace. They cannot prevent these beings from picking us like lice out of the hair of the dog at will by the millions and either returning us or not returning us. They can't admit to the world that they can do nothing about that. And so they keep it secret.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I remember as a young person, you know, being enthralled by the beauty that I saw in America. For instance, I mean, I really don't want to make this in some kind of patriotic sense for America, but I have to say this from the UK point of view, shall we say. I mean, I remember seeing lovely films like, you know, This Wonderful Life or Moonlight Bay and all the rest of it, where there was something sweet and gentle and really neat, if you like, about the American way of outlook and so forth. And yet, look at what has happened now under the stream of some very unworthy men, perhaps. I won't name names. But that lovely leadership that once, you know, made everybody love America, Walt Disney or whatever.
Yeah, we abdicated it.
Seems to have taken a holiday, shall we say. We are hoping that there are still some in there being, one of the world's greatest influencers and so forth, in opinion and so forth, that maybe some way it may start again. But what we have are paranoid people thinking the most awful things, seeing different outlooks as a threat instead of a partnership, to try to work things out so forth.
There you have it.
Instead of trying to preach this in some kind of... I'm sorry. I hope I don't sound some holier-than-thou individual. But really, as an ordinary individual...
No, not at all.
Like children, this is what I would hope for.
Herodotus said that it is the death of any government when the people can vote for themselves a piece of the coffer. And what has happened is politicians in our country have played upon that public greed and have literally hired the public to vote for them. And that's the condition we find ourselves in, $1.3 trillion deficit.
Yes.
And it's got to stop.
That's true. But, I mean, you know, whatever the deficit might be and whatever contrivances there might be. You know, I was reading a book recently by a chap called Nick Redfern. It really is something that people – I'm not selling this, but let me tell you, it is something I really was struck by. It's a book called Final Events and the Secret Government Group on demonic UFOs and the afterlife or whatever. And Nick is just a commentator. He just presents evidence. He has no views of his own. And he talks about a kind of cartel in the U.S. government called the Collins Elite. And it really just opened my eyes as to what paradigms might exist there that we might face. And I think, you know, it's something that people ought to take a look at, quite simply to be able to decide for themselves where we as a natural notional entity called humanity might be going, especially in the face of an apparent threat like we are finding with this phenomenon of UFOs and the Greys and so on.
Well, I like Nick Redfern. I've had him on the program. He's at least he's an open-minded journalist, and he brings great ideas together.
That's a wonderful thing. Yes, I think that he does. He does have a neutral sense about all of this. He just presents it, and of course, some people might find ideas that are bizarre, and some people might find that ideas that actually hold together. But I think it is something. You know, there is no risk at all in looking as wide as possible.
No,
in fact, the wider the field of knowledge, the greater would be the ability for us to decide where the truth might lie. And the more you narrow down your vision, the less you will be able to understand. It's a very simple logical paradigm, surely.
Yes, and half the battle is just getting everyone to agree that they exist. Once we realize
look for evidence without prejudice. Look for it as neutrally as you can. Take away the prejudices hitched up to your eyes, for instance. Those are the most dangerous. You know, this guy's nose is bigger, or this guy's color is slightly less than pink or whatever.
Right.
Those things are very, very dangerous, because what you do is you divorce yourself from any place that you might have to, for instance, expedite a karmic debt. And I believe that karma is simply cause and effect. If you did something in some kind of lifetime to do an injustice to somebody, you can be absolutely sure if there is a singularity that brings everything together, you might call God, you have to be absolutely sure that that singularity would demand the adjustment of that balance.
That's somehow. Right. You will be sent back to this earth white.
Absolutely. You send yourself back, because I think no one does the sending, you know. I think there is no such thing as an independent resolution except the power of the singularity that demands recompense in some kind of way.
Which is your own conscience. Remember, that singularity is within you, within everyone. So having that within you, you'll see yourself reflected against it and see where you've gone wrong.
And that's the beautiful thing that NDEs show. Because NDEs actually show that particular thing in many, many experiences one reads, that there's a life review. And it shows you, without judgment, without any kind of sense of punishment, whatever, where you went wrong and where you might be right.
As we said, people report experiencing where they've gone wrong, what they've done to other human beings that was detrimental. They feel that being done to them. As though they actually are all one, which would make sense if that's actually what we are. And that's what logic and reason suggest, as Schrödinger realized.
Well, so I suggest you learn from people's near-death experiences so that when your complete death experience happens,
absolutely,
you'll be empowered.
And of course, you know, the problem there, if I'm sorry to interrupt you, Brooks, but the problem there is that, you know, we have this subjective element in us that always looks to propagate our own self-interest. And that comes, I think, out of something that seeks to preserve ourselves as ourselves. Now, that might be a worthy thing, but when that goes over the top, so to speak, used over the top, then we begin to cause a big problem.
Mm. Well, the other extreme to that is the Christ. So you need to decide where along that spectrum you belong and where you want to be. And if you
I think that's what really brings this book entirely together.
Yeah, is that, you know,
Nigel ends his book with this treatise on the shroud, and Andrew has gone through how a man can effectively translate himself almost pretty well out of the universe, because the way in which this image was made on this shroud meant that the body had to physically disappear. And really, you know, that's consistent with evidence we have at the moment about quantum foams, etc., really encompassing two-dimensional and one-dimensional structures. Of course, those are not going to be directly observable from a three-dimensional universe. And as Nigel said, you know, the body itself can untwist its atoms, etc. And we've established that the thought process, in fact, is responsible for both twisting, and through free will, as Andrew said, we can choose to untwist at the same time. And I think this is what brings the whole story together, is that what teachers like Jesus, Buddha, etc., were really suggesting is that if one changes one's mind from a separationist point of view to bringing things together point of view, we can unravel the atoms and effectively use our biochemistry against its origin towards devolution, and actually reverse that process, so we can actually go to this singularity where really we don't have to come back anymore, because we're actually a part of that original function.
That's the goal. That's the goal right there.
No one punishes us, Brooks. We punish ourselves.
Sure.
And that's the most important rule of all. We punish ourselves for the lack of our insight and so forth. And that's what we see in what we call the rooms of death before we come back again in another lifetime to try to correct it. The problem is, where do we reincarnate? We may not be able to reincarnate in the actual situation where we need to be. We might have to take a secondary place, if you like. like, and then finding our way in a physical life, which means we have to grow up and understand enough and so on. Yeah. There is a delay mechanism. So there's a lot of detritus and noise to have to go through to do it this way. We might as well do it in one lifetime if we got the truth.
Yes.
You know, in the end, if we've got this problem about, you know, greys or existentially, you know, things like the greys, machines or whatever, coming and interfering with this natural process, we have a problem. The greys can only exist for life, I think. They are adapting us for their kind of existence, heading only for the only immortality that they can know.
Well, maybe we draw them in and coax them out of their machines.
You bet. They do. And, we draw them in. And then you've seen the most salient point of all. We draw them in by our ignorance.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, we're completely out of time. I have to tell you, it's been a fantastic experience, Nigel, and Doctors Biggerstaff and Silverman. I really appreciate your input. We have had one of the most lively conversations that I think I've ever had on X Squared Radio. I love the book. The publisher calls it Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of the Souls. I don't know what Nigel's title for the book is, but maybe he'll tell us. It's available everywhere, so go out and get a copy. It's substantial, and I promise you'll like it. I appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the plug.
Thank you, Robert. And
most of all, thank you for your patience and your understanding and the fact that you weren't tempted to interrupt, because I'll tell you what, you have greater patience than I have.
Well, my producer doesn't like that, actually. He wants me to interrupt you and step on you, and I tell him, look, this is X Squared Radio. In here, the results are always positive, okay? Everything we put into that function comes out positive. That's why our listeners come here, so I let you pontificate
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, and good day to you gentlemen there in the UK. I know it's late. Thank you very much.
Well,
for
if there's a God,
time.
May bless you and your producer.
Well, I accept the blessings and return them to you tenfold.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Well, that's it for X Squared Radio. It will be Sunday when you hear this. We actually recorded this on September 30th because of time constraints and scheduling, and very, very gracious to be able to put this together for you. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.